Todd.
Hey, buddy.
That's him. So Todd, dude, thank you for joining me today. You just landed a placement.
I did.
You're killing it.
Thank you.
Honestly, we had about 3 weeks or so before we actually could like get this scheduled in. I think we just had so much scheduling conflicts and it was terrible. I'm so sorry, but thank you for joining me on the amazing Bat Pitch podcast. but anyways, dude, congrats on your placement you just landed.
Thank you, man.
Dude, I want to kind of get into it and just talk about, you know, you, where you're from, pursuing music. So let's start out. Where are you from, man?
Right now I'm in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Okay.
Good old Mormon country.
So. Hell yeah, dude. Well, you said right now, where are you originally from?
Well, I grew up here. We're planning on moving in a couple of years. So.
Where are you thinking of going?
LA. You know
what? Goes, so. It's so funny. As soon as you get past Chicago, like as soon as you go west of Chicago, everyone is going to LA. As soon as you get east of Chicago, everyone's going to New York.
Maybe Nashville.
Maybe Nashville. But as soon as you said Salt Lake City, I'm not going to be here for long. I'm like, he's going to LA, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. No, if you're from Utah, you go to LA. That's just kind of the unspoken rule for.
Well, how's the music scene in Salt Lake City? I've actually heard like some really cool stuff come out of there. It seems like there's a pretty vibrant art scene.
There's some cool stuff. I would say that it's a lot of like smaller kind of underground indie type of artists. Not a lot of people who are doing a lot of kind of more mainstream commercial stuff.
Yeah.
If you're doing like mainstream commercial stuff, you're probably doing it for the Mormon church.
Got it. Okay.
Kind of the way that the, because it's a relatively small music scene.
Well, you know, I'm in Charlotte and like, you know, DaBaby popped up, you know, the past couple of years, but like before that it was really, I mean, we had a couple like mid-sized artists, like Avid Brothers are out of here, you know, some of that, but really there was just like a lot of gospel and CCM, and I'm Jewish. So I didn't know of it, you know? We had Anthony Hamilton, you know, based out of here. But, you know, similar to like Salt Lake back then, this was like 10 years ago or something. It's definitely not the case anymore. But there's like a lot of like, you know, big churches with like big CCM bands. You would meet these incredible musicians and I'm like, oh, do you have an original project out? And they're like, no, I play at church. And I'm like, what? Are you like touring on your own stuff? And they're like, no, it's like my weekend gig. And I'm like, okay, all right, cool. Like,
yeah. I mean, sometimes they sustain like the religious groups will sustain the entire music industry in an entire city.
So I've seen that like in a lot of like smaller or like mid-sized cities where like the de facto music industry where like, you know, if you're in, I don't know, it's either you go in like the wedding band, cover band, teaching route, or you play at church.
Seems
to be like those are the de facto music industries for mid cities and smaller cities, which is interesting.
Salt Lake's kind of a mid-sized city too, so I mean, I grew up here, started making music here with my band in high school and everything. I think that's kind of how metal hardcore type of
hell
stuff,
yeah,
you know? Like A Day to Remember, The Devil Wears Prada, just like that old stuff, like the right scene on music that everybody listened to in 2010.
Warped Tour, dude, that's where we all that's where all of the teenagers went to get fucked up, like every time. I go to Warped Tour. I was so disheveled and sunburned by the time I got home. I never brought enough water.
Oh, man. They were such messes, dude. I think that, I mean, if Warped Tour was still going on these days, there has to be some human rights violations, dude. Like, there had to have been.
My buddy Brandon Hinson, really good friend of mine here in Charlotte, he runs his own live production company now, but he was VP of Live Nation Carolinas, and a good buddy of his was, I forgot the guy's name, but he owned and like founded Warped Tour. He was good friends with him. And, I'm now on the other side, right? I'm like, back then we were like consuming, but it's like, all right, now I'm in the industry. So I was asking him, I was like, dude, like, so how was, you know, cause like, you know him, like, what did that look like? And he's like, honestly, dude, it was, even though like, it was like a mess a lot of times, logistically, it was like the most genius shit in the world because it was a huge caravan. Everything was so organized, like down to the last minute of when somebody shows up here, when that person shows up here, when this meal starts on this side of the tent, like all this crazy stuff. And he was like, It was like the most organized circus you could ever imagine.
Dude, yeah, Warped Tour did feel like a traveling circus.
Well, so I guess I'm forgetting the guy's name. Let me look this up real quick. Founder of Warped Tour. Okay, so founder of Warped Tour, Kevin Lyman. So yeah. I guess from what my buddy Brandon told me, Kevin earlier on actually studied, and this is like folklore, so like this might not be accurate, but what Brandon told me is he actually like earlier on essentially like kind of studied or at least took note of like Ringling Brothers and like all of this traveling circuses, because if you think about it, like circuses were a logistical nightmare and they were so organized. Like
totally. Yeah.
2 weeks before the train shows up, you have like an elephant go through town with like a big sign on its ass saying circus is coming. You know, everyone puts up the posters, then they get there and then everything's set up within like 12 hours. Everything's packed up and then they just keep going and they have, it's crazy. So apparently that's why it was like so organized, but I was always super impressed by that.
Dude, yeah. Warped Tour. I mean, that's kind of, I think, where a lot of these, like the music was born for like a lot
yes.
of the teenagers at the time, you know, like, and in my brain, it was the same way. So.
Yeah. Well, I think, I don't know, like, you're a millennial, like myself.
I think I fall under that. I'm 27.
Okay. So. Okay. Yeah. We're millennials. Yeah. Cool. The joke is that boomers didn't get fucked over. And so that's why allegedly they're unaware. Not obviously that's a terrible stereotype. Right. And then millennials, halfway through our life, we realized we were fucked from college. Like college was not going to work out. And then Gen Z knew just the idea of college, they were fucked. So it's like boomers never got fucked. Millennials, we got switched over. And then Gen Z was like, Gen Z never had hope. So
totally.
I think for us millennials going to Warped Tour, that was like the, you know, I think like there's some like underlying anxiety among all of us that like these next couple years are going to look real weird.
Yeah, absolutely.
We were all kids from the Great Recession, you know?
Dude. Yeah, exactly. So I think that's why a lot of us turned to the scene music, right? The hardcore music, right? So
I was in a hardcore band, man. Couple.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, like they're a dime a dozen for millennial kids, man. So yes. I was the same way.
what did you play?
I played lead guitar.
So. Okay. I was drummer.
Yeah. So. Nice. Yeah.
Yeah, man.
I started this band with my best friend for the last 12 years or so. I met him in high school. He drummed in our band.
Nice.
And then I played guitar, and then we brought in a bunch of other dudes. Had a great time. Like it was kind of a crazy situation.
Dude.
Because
yes.
Yeah. Like we didn't have a bassist and we couldn't find one because we went to a really small school.
So you
school.
Find a friend and you're like, this one's easy. Is that what you did?
Yeah. We were like, hey, learn bass for this band.
No, seriously. Because nobody wanted to play bass, but people wanted to hang out. So you're just like, hey, we like you. Listen, just play the root note the whole fucking time and you're in.
Dude, literally. And that's like that genre, like that hardcore sound, that's all it is. It's just playing the roots and then playing some breakdowns. It's the easiest. So, yeah. And I mean, it was crazy too, because there were originally five of us. We had our vocalist, he was doing like screaming and everything. And we weren't planning on anyone else. We were just going to have screaming vocals or whatever. And then randomly our bassist brought a friend to band practice one time. And this friend happened to just be a good singer. And at some point towards the end of practice, they were like, hey, do you want to be in the band?
Yeah.
Not even planning on it. So.
Yep. No, I had, so the first hardcore band that I was in, the screamer, his name was Rafer. And that is the dude's first name. And I haven't talked to him for over a decade. I doubt we'll ever talk again. Great guy. I mean, we didn't have a falling out, but we stopped talking. But we had a buddy who showed up to practice named Phil. Well, Philip. But I guess Rafer's ex-girlfriend was like Philip's current girlfriend. It was this weird thing. But there was like no animosity because I don't know why. But Philip could sing. And so by the end of practice, he was in band. We played a show like 2 weeks later. Real quick. I'm so sorry. I got to tell this story. Because it's rare that we really bring up the hardcore days, you know. We played this hardcore show out in the middle of like nowhere. Okay. I thought it was like going to be, I just wanted to play, man. Like it was, you know, These were the bands and I just wanted to play shows. We showed up to this house and, you know, I didn't drink, I didn't do drugs, but all my friends did. You know, We show up and I thought we're going to play the show. And like the singer is like Rafer, I think it was Rafer at the time. He's like making out with all these girls like on stage. And I'm just like playing. The band basically just falls apart. My buddy Aaron, because, you know, you do like the crab core thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The stage was like this old sort of patio kind of thing, or like a deck. And I guess part of the wood was rotted. He crab cores. His leg literally falls through the floorboard. It's like bleeding everywhere. And then again, I don't drink. I'm not doing drugs. Like I'm not doing any of that. And I guess the mom at this place decided that she was going to let everybody drink. So of course the cops show up and I'm like, you know, neurotic me. I'm the only one there that did not partake in anything. And I'm freaking out. It's like 3 a.m. I'm like hiding in the woods with my drum pedal. Call up my parents. I'm like, I still want to get into Berkeley. Like, I don't drink. I don't do drugs.
That's so funny.
That was ninth grade for me, man. So.
Dude, that sounds like a nightmare of a show. We definitely had some similar ones to that. It's just kind of that was just, you know, 2009, 2010, that kind of general time. That was just what it was. So that was, that was me for four-ish years or whatever.
Yep.
You know, and then at some point, yeah, I had the mop, you know,
hell yeah, dude.
In my hair, we had like the really tight, the jeggings, right? That's what they call them.
Dude, I still wear them, man. I got my...
Nice. Yeah, the skinny jeans are a staple for millennials, for sure, dude.
Your legs can't breathe. That's part of it.
There's something comforting about them hugging your legs.
So after the hardcore band broke up, like all do, what was kind of the next stage for Todd? What'd you start doing then?
So I think, at one point when I was still in the band, we met a group of guys that was in another hardcore band and we just ended up being kind of like soul sisters type of thing. Like we played almost every show together at one point.
Band
one
buddies,
of their guitarists quit. Yeah. Yeah. And I actually ended up filling in on guitar for them for about trading the last year.
Yep. Got the, I got.
So there would be a lot of shows where I'd play two sets in a row, be exhausted. Uh-huh. We started recording just like ourselves because we recorded we never got anything like solid at a professional studio, right? But we got a couple of demos with a couple of dudes and then we ended up just trying to do stuff ourselves. And our rhythm guitarist at the time, who I actually ended up starting a studio with later on, him and I kind of started learning a little bit more of like, oh, like this is what producing is. Like this is what a DAW is, you know, like this is what an audio interface is, just like the basic stuff to kind of get into the production side of things. Cause up to that point, I'd only ever written and performed, right? I had never even thought about production or anything like that, right? And so at one point we started feeling a little bit like cocky because we weren't good, but we thought we were good.
Dude, that's part of being in a hardcore band is like, exactly, we're a huge deal, although we all sound like shit.
There's this thing. Do you know what the Dunning-Kruger effect is?
No.
So it's, I'll have to send it to you later.
Let me look it up. Look it up. Dunning-Kruger effect. Okay. Oh, this is good. I'm going to do a screen share on this.
Yeah. Do that.
Okay. So this is actually hilarious. Okay. So
this is every musician ever.
The Dunning-Kruger effect, if you're watching on YouTube, you can see this. If you're just listening on podcast, I'm sorry. But the Dunning-Kruger effect occurs when a person's lack of knowledge and skills in a certain area causes them to overestimate their own competence. By contrast, this effect also causes those who excel in a given area to think the task is simple for everyone and underestimate their relative abilities as well. So it's like... Yeah.
It's basically the less you know, the more you think you know, and the better you think you are, right? So so that's how I was. Like, I had been recording for 2 weeks. I had barely learned what an EQ was, and I was like, this shit is easy, man. I can do this for anyone else, right?
Yeah.
So we brought in, like, our friend, our sister band or whatever. We, like, had them record. We did, like, some demos. And, I mean, looking back, they're not the worst demos in the world, all things considered. But that kind of, I think, was my first taste of, like, music production.
Well, right? I mean,
doing it for myself.
Here's the thing is, like, I actually think it's good for people to kind of enter music naively. Like, when you when you know too much, like, dude, Sync, bro. Years ago, when I first started that pitch, I barely knew shit about Sync. I was just like, here's a problem. Here's a solution. I'm going to give it a shot for a year. If I make a bunch of people money, I'll continue doing it. If I don't, all right, well, that was a fun idea I tried, you know? And it just started taking off. And I was like, okay, cool. Well, I guess I got to learn a lot more about this now. And yeah, I think, like, any self-respecting business owner or music business person or just music maker in general is, like, trial by fire. Like, when I was if I'm working in a studio or something, a lot of times you just, like, don't know, you know, how the board is set up. Like, you have to learn, and you kind of have to bullshit a little bit to figure it out. If you have a client there, they don't want to hear that you don't know what's going on. They just want to know that their record's getting done. So you just got to, like, play it cool. And I think it's good to be naive and, like, put yourself in a situation.
I think so too.
Like, even you being in Salt Lake City, the fact that you're not around the industry in LA or New York or Nashville, I think puts you at an advantage, because you're going to try stuff that you might otherwise not, because mob mentality would tell you not to try it out. Because
you always have different perspectives based on location, culture, upbringing, all that different stuff.
When I started that pitch, everybody I knew in LA, like in the industry, or, like, trying to be in the industry, and, like, they were just all totally talking shit about it. This was, like, years ago. And now it's paid out millions and millions of dollars to people. So, like, you know, now they're signed up.
Now they're trying to get some of that green too.
Right. They're like, dude, I always believed in you. And I was like, you did?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Why not?
Whatever. But I have no animosity. I still have no idea what I'm doing.
That's how I feel too. I mean, and I think that that's kind of exactly what the Dunning-Kruger effect is too, is the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know, right?
Yeah.
But when you don't know anything, like, and it's good, because, like, those rose colored glasses help you get started, and they help you make a lot of progress up front. So.
It motivates you. And, like, I think, you know, listen, if you're, in my opinion, I don't think anybody pursues music seriously without having gone through some sort of internal trauma or something as a kid that,
or, like, some crises here and there.
Yeah, so. Just some extreme stress where you're like, I need to really throw myself into art and express myself. Like,
100%.
You know, so I think even if you make yourself look like an idiot at the start, because, like, you think you know what you're doing or whatever, maybe you come across a little bit too confident or whatever. If that gives you enough identity and, like, self-esteem to pursue a direction that you stay out of trouble, you know, the alternative being, like, getting into drugs and, like, just getting into bad shit or whatever, like, I think it's a net good. But the goal is that people correct themselves, and they're like, I kind of looked like a twerp. Like,
I feel that's exact. I agree. I think that you gotta be a little stupid for a while, because being kind of stupid makes you persistent, and you're gonna keep pushing against the grain.
As long as you're self aware, you know.
Yeah. At some point, you gotta kind of learn. Like, man, I was so silly. I was a goofy little guy.
But,
you know.
Yeah, but it's also, like, you know, putting yourself in a position where you are not shit. You know, I think that's, if you stay in, like, a smaller town, or you stay in a smaller community, and you don't meet anyone online, or you don't travel somewhere or experience more, you're likely going to think that you're better than you are. But if you, like, kind of get that perspective, you know, and, like, get out and realize that you're not shit. That's why I like traveling to New York as much as I can, is because it's just such a great, I don't know, like, you're in Salt Lake City. It's not that much smaller than Charlotte. It's like, you know, you know the roads, you see the people. It's a great community. But when I go to New York, I just feel so fucking small and so insignificant. It's so great.
Yeah. It's like a cool, it's like a good feeling too.
Yes.
Because, like, being in, you feel kind of I mean, that phenomenon, right? Like the big fish in a small pond. It's so true, you know, like it's such a factual, like psychological thing. And whenever I get over to California, like it doesn't even have to be LA, it could be San Diego or whatever. I'm always
somewhere.
Man, I gotta be here. You know, I feel so insignificant, and that's such a cool feeling by comparison to how I feel right now.
You gotta shake up the snow globe, you know, just make something happen. So anyways, so kind of going back.
We got into it, and obviously we were not good in everything, but it was my first take for producing, right? Yeah. And so my rhythm guitarist from my band and I, we had this idea. We were like, what if we just like started a studio or whatever? And we started recording other people, right? I think that a lot of hardcore kids kind of take that route as well, right?
Me included. So, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's super common.
We're making no money from our shows, so we can't pay for studio time.
Exactly. So just make your own studio.
Right. I know what a Tascam looks like.
Dude, oh man, the Tascam days, dude.
Tascam, I got Tascam and I got Cubase. Let's give it a shot.
Dude, yeah. For me, it was Reaper and Tascam, you know?
Okay.
So, but yeah, like we started a studio, and over a couple of years, we kind of had better ideas on what to do with it. Eventually, we had some really cool ideas where we basically started building vocal booths in like trailers, like mobile trailers and stuff.
Nice.
And we have a couple right now. This studio is still going, actually, but it now exists as kind of like a rental thing. So we will rent out these trailers to artists who just want to use it as like a vocal booth and everything. Super cool kind of concept. I can't take credit for all of it, but our studio for a while ended up being a lot of like, we would do a lot of the, you know, recording, we'd do producing, we'd do mixing, we'd do mastering, we'd do everything. And we were overall kind of bad at all of it, because when you try to stretch yourself so thin, obviously it doesn't always end up giving you the highest distinct quality in one area. But I realized at one point when I started producing more stuff for some of the rappers that we would meet, because rappers tend to veer a little bit more towards like cheaper options for studios and stuff like that. I realized like a lot of them would ask me to like produce beats for them and stuff. And I had the advantage and the benefit of meeting a couple who were very, not only were they very like open-minded and stuff like that, but they also were very experimental. So I got to start making hip hop beats with kind of some of my hardcore influence. So I had incorporate, like aspects like double tracking or like putting a plate verb on the snare or whatever. You know, just like things that aren't normally in hip hop. I was able to start doing for these artists and everything, and they really liked it. Yeah. And at some point, I think that me being introduced to making music in a genre I had never even thought about before, because I never listened to hip hop growing up, kind of exposed me to like this whole different world I'd never considered. And so producing music became kind of like a big thing that I just started learning a lot. A lot of people would like find us, you know, our studio, and obviously me being kind of the creative side and my business partner at the time, you know, my old rhythm guitarist being the business side, you know.
Hell yeah.
The two of us kind of had this agreement where I'd just do like the production and stuff like that whenever someone would find us. So I'd randomly get someone who would be like, hey, can you make like a reggaeton type of beat or whatever? And I was like, I don't even know what that is. You know? Yeah. I started learning all these styles, and I think I just really took to producing. And this was probably 2018. So I think I've been producing music in my like current capacity for about 4 to 5 years now, whereas before I was just producing like hardcore music.
Sure.
I was just writing, recording myself. And I just took a real big like affinity to it. For a while there, I was trying my hand more at mixing, and then a little bit with like mastering, and then even some business stuff as well.
Yeah.
But I always kind of found myself coming back to just this huge love of producing music.
It's great.
Which I'm great at like the rock stuff, you know, the metal stuff, because I grew up doing it. So I know exactly what it needs to sound like. I know what's going on. But honestly, man, like the sync stuff I've been working on, even outside of that pitch lately, a lot of it has been more EDM focused.
Nice.
And learning a genre that I never knew before, like EDM, has been so fun, you know? Like, and that's the thing that's so beautiful about being a producer in the sync stuff, is you basically get to like, there was the Afrobeats brief up last month, right?
Yeah.
I knew nothing about Afrobeat. I was like, I kind of want to try this one out, you know?
Right.
Like, and so I looked into it. I did some research and everything, and I just fell in love with the genre. I produced out 4 tracks. One of them got placed, which I'm super stoked about. And like, that's been kind of the journey, my whole sync journey, which is like, I don't know anything about this style. I'm going to learn how to make it.
Try it out.
The last couple of years of my life. So
that's awesome, man. Well, the whole thing is just like, you know, do, it sounds cliche because a lot of people say like, do what you love, but like, just do what's second nature. If you enjoy learning a new genre, then just like go all in, just be excited about whatever you're doing. You know what I'm saying? Totally. Yeah. Well, that's awesome, man. You're definitely building your catalog and, it's obviously working. You just landed a track with us, landed a world track. So that's fucking great, man. Yeah. Why don't we give that a listen? I really want to listen to this track that you just landed. And then we'll take it from there, right?
Yeah, let's do it.
Sweet. Here we go. This track is called, give me a second. Gotta open up this thing. Oh my goodness. Heart of Stone. Dude, that was dope.
Thanks, man.
That was dope. Lot of motifs going in and out. Really kind of minimal arrangement in the fact that there was just like a lot of like repeating parts in a good way. You didn't like try to change it up too much. Like the bridge had a solo. Other than that, you kind of just kept it to like the main lead parts. The drums didn't change much. It was just a groove. Like that's great, man. So it was just enough action where it would go great under really like any sort of film. It wasn't taking away too much and it set a vibe.
Yeah, totally. It's the type of style too, where, I mean, I spent quite a while researching it too. And Afrobeat's kind of notorious for being a lot of just like repeated rhythms and riffs over and over again, you know? So I had to switch it up enough to make sure that it was still, you know, usable and flexible enough for supervisors and editors and stuff like that.
Yep.
But what I love about, I've been on this kind of, kick lately where I've been trying to go with a little bit more of like the less is more mentality.
Yeah.
Where rather than just like adding a bunch of instruments, you just have very high quality instruments doing very high quality riffs and then kind of switching up those riffs enough to give the feel of progression, growth, and change throughout the song.
Yeah, so. Man. I mean, the way that I produce, honestly, I've kind of been having this sort of mentality for like a while now. It's just like add literally whatever the fuck you want, like during the production process, and just try to take as much away as possible before export, like before bouncing it. So I'll just like mute as much shit as possible where it's still there. It's like just concentrating like what actually matters. And you'd be surprised like what the stuff actually matters, like what's actually left. And usually you can get a lot from a little, you know?
Yeah.
You can feel the same thing from less stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's kind of what's going on too, is like, I remember when I was working on these tracks, I actually made a point to I said I was going to use as many real instruments as possible for it. So I went out, I bought myself a new bass guitar because I haven't had a bass guitar for a couple of months now, invested quite a bit of money in it. And then I set up in my corner here, you can't see it now, but I set up in my corner a whole miniature drum kit. And then I have like my tambourine, my cajon, my other percussion.
Yeah, your cajon, right on.
Yeah, yeah. So like all of the percussion in that song, there's maybe a couple samples here and there, but everything else is real, you know.
Thing is, like, one shot samples are great. Obviously, like, we never use loops in sync because, like, it'll just have a copyright problem. But, like, you know, for one shots, like, you can get away with just like using one shots and splice. But, like, as a drummer myself, like, nothing really beats having like the real shit, you know, at least in tandem with samples. Like, you always want to have at least like one real sound to kind of glue the rest of the arrangement together. You know what I'm saying?
Right. And obviously I'm a guitarist too. So like it's a track that I'm proud of mostly just because like maybe 90% of it is real instruments. You know, that's me hitting the ride. That's me hitting those hi-hat articulations, you know, like that's me doing those flat bass parts. And I'm not even really a bassist or anything.
But you figure it out like, enough. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And like for me, I think that that's kind of the big thing that that made the tracks kind of come together too is the real instruments, but especially like that bass line too. It's because
it sounded great.
If I had programmed that bass line, people would know, and it wouldn't have the same kind of groove to
That's the thing. At the end of the day, like, you know, you don't have to be an incredible instrumentalist. You just have to be willing enough to noodle it for, you know, as much as possible to get the riff down, you know.
Our DAWs can do so much. We can edit whatever we need to.
You can, you know, flip or manipulate whatever you want, but you can just kind of get like the initial sound in. Like that goes a long way. So anyways, I really love that. Dude, this is so firstly, thank you so much for coming on today. You're killing it. Man. Love this track.
Thank you.
I want to ask you two questions before we wrap up. It's something I ask everybody on the That Pitch podcast. So number one, what advice would you give to anyone pursuing music, a career in music? And where can people find you online?
Oh, okay. So the second one's easier. So I only use Instagram. So it's at Todd, @Todd_T_Tran, Tran. So again, Todd_T_Tran. As for the first question, I feel like just like in music in general or like sync?
Sync. I mean, maybe obviously both. It's a sync show, but like music industry, whatever, man, just whatever is, whatever's
I would
coming.
Say, yeah, yeah. I would say the big thing that's been on my mind lately is like, stop trying to find shortcuts.
Yeah.
There's like this big kind of push lately that's kind of, you know, anti-music theory or just using one plugin that fixes it all and everything.
Right.
And it's kind of like that stuff can be useful tools or whatever, like those plugins, obviously. Being anti-music theory is kind of silly, but like
it makes no sense. It's like we all listen to music that uses theory, so unless you want to go into like microtonal music for a Western audience, you know,
which even
not a big market,
even still has its place in theory.
Yeah, small place, but it has a place.
Exactly. Yeah, but like I think for me, like the idea is like there's not like a shortcut. Right. Like if you want to like kind of get into the music industry more, like it's definitely largely networking, like who you know and everything like that. Go to shows, meet people. But a big aspect of it is just legitimately being like good at your craft, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that for me, as soon as I genuinely started respecting music as an art form rather than just thinking, oh, this is just something I do for fun, or this is a way that I can make money or whatever.
Yes.
And I started thinking of it as this beautiful entity in and of itself. And I started to begin to seek like mastery of music. That's when I started becoming really good at producing. My intuition took me really a lot farther, and it got me noticed by the people who actually, you know, really matter. And that's how I have a job today making music full time, is because I just ended up deciding at one point, like I want to understand and master this as an art form. And it ended up leading me down roads of education and seeking knowledge that I never would have thought about before. And those things got heard by the right people. So if you combine those two, it's great. And then like when it comes to sync stuff, I've noticed that my entire, like all of my success in sync is literally just following the brief. Like when you follow the brief, when you really just like listen to the references and try to capture that same energy, you're going to be fine, because a lot of, I think, people have this problem where they think that, oh, like, it's a lo-fi brief, so I'm going to throw in like whatever beats that I have just sitting on my hard drive. And it's like, that's not necessarily following the brief. And it also shows the same thing, which is, I think, kind of a disregard for music as the art form. People don't want lo-fi as in like, oh, just send us whatever beats you have lying around that might sound kind of low quality. Like, people don't want that, right? People want lo-fi because it evokes a specific emotion, a specific feeling, you know, like there's specific aspects, like music theory aspects of it that are essential to it in a sync, as a sync thing, right? So I think that it even ties in there. Like, if you respect the art form of music, even lo-fi music, which in my opinion is like a little bit more of an entry-level genre in a lot of ways, then you go so much farther. And that leads to, you know, if you respect the brief, you're going to get the placements. So I would say that anybody listening, it's all about that. It's like, learn to respect music as an art form and then seek to understand it for what it is. And then just follow the briefs if you want to get sync placements.
Amazing. I'm going to give you a little clap here. Watch, here we go. Woo! Really stoked about these samples that come with this software. Fantastic answer. Love that. Thank you, man. Like, I think the past couple of years, like, you and I grew up on the tail end of when, like, you would get a studio internship, you would go to real studios. And then really, like, a couple of years after, people started just like using their laptop from the get-go, you know, they never went to a real studio. Nothing against that. It kind of became a video game versus like respecting the art and like learning theory and like working your ass off. Nothing against that. Again, it's just like a different perspective on the same trajectory, you know? Exactly. So I think kind of getting back to the roots is really important. Love that. Dude, thank you so much for doing this today.